From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with Mary King. She's written a civil rights movement memoir called Freedom Song about her years as communications coordinator for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Also today, I talk with singer Frankie Lane. He has a new record reprising the Western themes he made famous, like High Noon and Rawhide. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews some of the vintage concert recordings preserved by the Music and Arts Programs of America. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg reads the headlines and translates the more flamboyant ones. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Mary King. She's written a civil rights movement memoir from her perspective as a young white woman who worked in a mostly black, largely male-dominated civil rights group. It's titled Freedom Song, a personal story of the 1960s civil rights movement. During the height of the civil rights movement, from 1962 to 65, King was the communications coordinator for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, working with communications director Julian Bond. SNCC, as the committee was commonly known, was one of the more militant groups working for racial equality and the group that first popularized the term black power. As communications coordinator, it was Mary King's job to get the national media to cover SNCC demonstrations and to report on the beatings and harassment directed against SNCC workers. It was King who called the prisons in Mississippi and the State Highway Patrol, trying to locate three SNCC volunteers, Andrew Goodman, James Cheney, and Mickey Schwerner, who disappeared while traveling through rural Mississippi. All three were later found shot and beaten to death. Mary King left SNCC just before the group voted to expel whites. She later entered government service. President Jimmy Carter appointed her deputy director of action with responsibility for the volunteers in the Peace Corps and VISTA. Mary King now works in the private sector trying to open up markets for American technology in the third world. Her new memoir is called Freedom Song. Mary King, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
I think we all had our consciousness raised watching the evening news in the 1960s and seeing civil rights demonstrators being harassed by police, beaten, hosed with fire hoses, attacked by police dogs. It was your job to get the press to cover those demonstrations. As the communications coordinator, what was the importance of having the press at the demonstrations in the South?
Well, it was more than just getting press coverage. Really, the only protection that we had for civil rights workers was the press. There was no other protection. We have to remember that we were working in an era of state-condoned terrorism or state-conducted terrorism. That is, sheriffs and law officers were either the perpetrators of the violence or in collusion with the vigilantes and terrorists. So then what could we do to offer protection to someone working on voter registration who was picked up and jailed and in the safety of secrecy that the sheriffs and the law officers could have had him beaten to smithereens? And many of my fellow workers had jaws broken and noses broken and were very fiercely beaten in jails. If we could get a reporter to a jail with a pad asking and inquiring, are you holding so-and-so in custody? Then the jailer or the sheriff knew that they were under surveillance, and that would modify their behavior somewhat, we hoped. The particular incident that you were talking about in 1964, on June 21, three of my fellow workers disappeared in late afternoon. It was a Sunday. And what I normally did when something like this happened was to call the jails. And so I called the jails in the five counties surrounding Neshoba County, Mississippi, to find out where they were being held. I was almost certain that they had been picked up and were being held in a jail. And I found that Deputy Sheriff Cecil Ray Price lied to me personally. It was later proven in court when he said, no, they're not here, they're not in detention. And not 3 or 4 hours later, he and other law officers took James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner out and shot them. 44 days later, their bodies were found buried under a dam. So the role of the press, it was not only so much in demonstrations, because the peak demonstrations that you now see replayed in a 10-second segment on the news when they talk about the civil rights movement, this is not really what the movement was about. The movement was tedious, and it was laborious. It was changing the hearts and minds of people. It was helping people who lived in fear under the rigid protocols of segregation to overcome that fear and to be willing to go down to register and vote.
So the press offered you at least two things. One was education for people who weren't present, and the other was a sense of security that with people watching, the demonstrators were less likely to be mistreated by the authorities. Was it hard to get the national press to come to small towns in the South to cover the demonstrations?
Very hard. You know, going back to the days of Rutherford B. Hayes, there had been a national deal cut that the country would look the other way and that the South do as it pleased with regard to black people. In the South itself, a black death was not considered newsworthy. If you read about a black person in the newspaper, it was usually about a crime, and they wouldn't even refer to that person by name. They would say the Smith woman or the Jones man. They wouldn't say Mr. Jones or Mrs. Smith as a gesture of ridicule or degradation. So we really had a problem because in order to make the rest of the country aware of what was going on, we had to have the press. We also needed the press for protection internally. The government of South Africa knows exactly what it's doing in banning the world's press, because if you can't hold up atrocities to the light of a larger morality, then the perpetrators of them are not forced to re-examine their behavior, and they can get away with blue murder, literally.
What did you do to get the press to come when you were having trouble?
Well, Julian Bond and I had a rather elaborate mechanism. We worked through Friends of SNCC organizations in other cities, Princeton, Portland, New York, Boston, Los Angeles, and so on, Chicago. And we would call when one of our workers was arrested or in jail or we heard that something had happened. We would call and alert them. They would then query the wire services and say, are you carrying a story on such and such? Of course, the wire services weren't carrying the story because the people in the state level and the Atlanta Bureau didn't think it was worth carrying in 99 out of 100 cases. But the fact that the inquiry had come in from Portland would mean that the wire services would then have to respond and they would have to send someone out to that jail to find out if they were there and being held. And by the time it went out from the Atlanta Bureau to the Northwest, that meant it had covered the country. So this was a rather elaborate network of contacts that Julianne and I plied to get the news stories out across the nation.
Is there any one demonstration where you thought that the presence of the national media really had a profound effect?
Well, I think that the Birmingham situation in 1963, where there were police dogs and fire hoses were used against children, that this really startled the country. Americans were revolted when they saw this. I think that that had an effect. But I'm reminded more of situations where we couldn't get the effect, such as when I was in Danville, Virginia, and again fire hoses were being used to wash people down the steps of the courthouse, people trying to register to vote. One night there was a prayer vigil, and 48 people were hospitalized as a result of the police brutality used on them afterwards. And I was indicted for acts of war and violence very shortly after I arrived in the town and had to escape across the state line to North Carolina, where a group of Roman Catholic nuns gave me asylum in a convent. And Richard Valeriani was there from NBC, and there were a couple of reporters from the Washington Post. But by and large, the situation in Danville was uncovered, was not covered by the news media. Had it been, it was a situation every bit as bad as Birmingham, and in some ways more so. The judge wore a pistol strapped to his waist in the courtroom. He arrested lawyers right in the middle of the courtroom. The whole justice system and the city hall was completely corroded by its insistence on adhering to the protocols of segregation. We really needed the press, and we couldn't get much in that situation.
My guest is Mary King, and she's written a memoir about her years in the civil rights movement. It's called Freedom Song, and she worked as communications coordinator for SNCC in part of the 1960s. You were a woman in SNCC who rose to a position of authority working with the media. Was there an obvious division of labor between the men and the women in SNCC during the years that you were there?
No, I would not call it a division of labor. I would say that there was a kind of tradition at work in which most of the spokespersons for the organization were male. But SNCC distinctively was responsive to the leadership of women in a way that the other civil rights organizations were not. SNCC had more women and more whites than all of the other organizations put together. And SNCC was open to Ella Baker, for example, was our senior advisor. And SNCC, an older, middle-aged black woman who had earlier been an advisor to Dr. King and was really pushed out of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, she was our senior advisor. She's a major political voice of American political struggle in the 20th century who's been looked over and missed. And I write about her influence on my own personal life, but also her influence on us was profound. And one of the things that she believed was that leadership must come from the bottom. And it was because of her influence and the importance of promoting local and indigenous leadership that a woman like Fannie Lou Hamer came to the fore. She was the last of 20 children in a sharecropper who'd been picking cotton since she was six and had no education, was evicted from a plantation when she registered to vote, but she went on to become a national orator and an organizer of great significance in Mississippi. Only in SNCC could that have happened.
Well, you know, you suggest in your book that one of the reasons why SNCC was less patriarchal than some of the other civil rights organizations was that it was one of the few organizations that wasn't based in the church and that wasn't therefore following the patriarchal model of the church.
Well, I think that's right. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference was much closer to the traditional ministerial leadership, and it defined its role as working to organize within the esteemed institution of the black church. SNCC was more diverse, we were more political, we were closer to the ground, and we were very, very young, Terry. Most of us were 22, 23. If you were 25, you were older. And we really didn't have careers. We weren't married. We didn't get salaries. We paid $9.64 every other week. We had nothing to lose. You know the popular song, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. We could afford to take a quite pure position on matters of leadership because we had so little built up for ourselves to lose.
But there were still obviously some inequities between men and women in the organization. And you wrote what is probably one of the first position papers from within the civil rights movement about the importance of equality between the sexes as well as between the races. And you quote an excerpt of that statement you wrote in your book, and I'd like to ask you to read part of the statement you wrote about sexism in the movement.
Well, I wrote this in 1964 when I was advocating for the SNCC staff that women's rights ought to be a part of the social justice agenda. What was really under consideration at that time, Terry, was whether we should become more democratic in our organization or more highly structured, more hierarchical. And I and another woman, Casey Hayden, along with Bob Moses and a number of others, argued for a more democratic method of decentralized, lots of local movements, each organized around their own passion or their own need. And in that context, in arguing for a more democratic approach, Casey and I said, well, women ought to be, the concerns of women ought to be able to be responded to within this context. And when I wrote this, I was afraid to circulate it with my name on it. And Casey and I polished it up, and then we circulated it anonymously because we were so afraid of ridicule. And when I read it today, it will seem amazing that in 1964, we could have been afraid of ridicule in a radical, militant civil rights organization. And the statement read, "The average white person finds it difficult to understand why the Negro resents being called boy or being thought of as musical or athletic, because the average white person doesn't realize that he assumes he is superior." Note the he's. "And naturally, he doesn't understand the problem of paternalism. So, too, the average SNCC worker finds it difficult to discuss the woman problem because of the assumption of male superiority. Assumptions of male superiority are as widespread and deep-rooted and every bit as crippling to the woman as the assumptions of white supremacy are to the Negro." And I believe this must have been one of the earliest articulations of that parallel.
Now, you said that you were afraid to sign your name to the statement because you thought you would be ridiculed. What made you think that?
There was brooding silence in those times. The word feminism did not exist. Much of the lingo of the women's movement today, the words hadn't even been coined. There was no awareness of women's rights. In law schools, there was no teaching of the question. This is something that has come on the stage in the United States in our very recent past.
Did being a white woman make it harder, too? Did you think that your intentions were going to be misunderstood because you were white and you were referring to black male chauvinism?
Well, this is a very interesting question. You know, my father was the sixth Methodist minister in five generations of Virginia and North Carolina-born Methodist ministers. And sometimes I felt that my Southern roots and my church roots were more significant than my being white. This began to change moving toward 1965. We had experienced a number of very disenchanting experiences. For example, with the death of the three men in Mississippi, President Johnson called the parents, the family of Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner, the two whites, and only a presidential assistant called the family of Jim Cheney, the one black among the three to be killed. The following year, in 1965, the Selma March began around the death of a teenage pulpwood cutter, black, Jimmie Lee Jackson, who was killed as he tried to help his mother and grandfather, who had been clubbed by the police in a demonstration. And he died. A few days later, a white minister came in from Boston, the Reverend James Reeb, and he was killed by a group of white thugs who attacked him outside a cafe. This time the entire country responded, but once again President Johnson sent Air Force One for his widow and flowers, and again only a presidential assistant called the family of Jimmie Lee Jackson. So we were encountering institutionalized racism at the very highest levels, right in the White House, in a White House that was, many people think, trying to do its best in the matter of race. We were experiencing the kind of hypocrisy of racism that was woven right into the fabric of America. And by 1965, many people began to wonder whether our nonviolent appeals for change were going to work. And in that atmosphere, as there was more and more disillusionment, we began to hear some of the rhetoric coming out of the northern urban ghettos, and more young people coming into SNCC at that time from those ghettos brought with them the talk of black separatism. Now, my way of looking at that today is entirely different from my way of looking at it then. At the time, I felt great pain because I had put my life on the line. I believed heart, mind, body, and soul I was committed to my fellow workers, and I would willingly have died for any of them. But as I heard the language of black nationalism, I didn't really understand it. Today, I realize very clearly that the question, are we Americans or are we Africans, still lingers in the minds of black Americans. And until black Americans know the answer to that question is an easy one, until black Americans can say, yes, we are fully, totally citizens, we are no longer a captive people, then there will always be logic to those who argue we must separate, we cannot find our destiny within the mainstream. At the time, I didn't realize that.
I want to get back to some of these issues in a couple of seconds, but we have to take a short break first. My guest is Mary King, and she's written a memoir about her years in the civil rights movement when she worked with SNCC. The book is called Freedom Song. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Mary King is my guest, the author of the new civil rights memoir, Freedom Song. I want to get back to the statement that you read, the statement which you had written about sexism within the civil rights movement. You were afraid you were going to be ridiculed and laughed at. What reactions did you get when the statement was anonymously circulated. Well, let's start with the men. What kind of reactions did you get from the men?
Oh, we did get a lot of ridicule and a lot of joking. There were a few people who were very sympathetic and proud of it, Bob Moses and Charlie Cobb. And there were others who were warm to it. But by and large, there was a fair amount of ridicule. It was early for this question to be raised.
And from women in SNCC?
Oh, great coolness. Very great remoteness on the part of most of them. It was many, many, many years later until I realized that the black men in SNCC today are extremely proud that the women's movement was really, in a sense, catalyzed from within the civil rights movement. And those the two papers that Casey and I wrote played a role in that. Today, black SNCC workers are very proud because they regard the women's movement as an inheritor movement to the civil rights movement. But at that time, they did not see it in that way.
You know, I want to ask you something that I asked you a couple of minutes ago, which was if you felt more uncomfortable writing this statement, being a white in a predominantly black group. Maybe what you were trying to say is that you hadn't really thought about it at the time you'd written it, that issue wasn't important to you?
That issue hadn't really emerged as an issue. I think that my proximity to the suffering of black people, the experiences I had spent Christmas in jail in 1963 in Atlanta for ordering a cup of coffee with my fellow workers, separated from the black SNCC workers that I was with because they wouldn't allow us to be together. So another woman, Nancy Stearns, now a civil liberties lawyer in New York, and I were thrown in with the white women prisoners. But I think that my awareness had begun to change because of my proximity to black belt, black people. And that is what induced in me an understanding of my position as a woman. If I was working on self-determination for blacks, eventually self-determination came to mean self-determination for me as a woman. And I think that my awareness was more of my being a woman than it was of my being white, although I think that may have compounded it.
I want to talk a little bit about what it was like for you to be a white working in a predominantly black organization at the height of the civil rights movement. And there's an image that really sticks in my mind. I think it was the first time you were arrested for a demonstration with a lot of other people. You were all thrown into prison. But there were two white women in the demonstration, and you were both put in the white part of the prison, and you were separated from all the other demonstrators, which meant that you were deprived of the kind of solidarity and strength that people who were imprisoned in groups had.
That's right.
You couldn't be singing freedom songs with
everyone.
Right. It must have been must have made you very aware of the fact, too, that you were white, that you were going to be seen differently, at least by outsiders.
Yes. It was very lonely and extreme situation for Nancy Stearns and me to be and locked up and separated. And we tried to get with the others. When the very bored jailers began to process us, they turned to Nancy and me and said, "What is your race?" And both of us looked at each other for an instant and blurted out, "We're Negro." And the processing jailer turned to his superior and uttered a series of expletives and said, here's some white girls who say they're colored. Now what are we going to do? But they refused to put us in with our fellow workers. And that was a very awful experience. We didn't dare tell anyone why we had been arrested because we saw the women prisoners fighting among themselves, and we knew that we would have been attacked and beaten if we had told anyone why we were there. When they asked us, we simply said what our charge was. Our charge was trespassing, and we just answered with that one word.
SNCC went through many changes during the years that you worked there. One of the changes was the vote to expel whites. No, you left the group shortly before that. That's a decision that's still, I think, discussed as one of the great controversies that came out of the civil rights movement.
I spent a long time working on that part of the book. It was very difficult for me, and it was emotionally difficult for me writing that whole section. I finally believe that I came to grips with it, and I feel very proud and very comfortable with my analysis of the situation. At the time, it was difficult, and I think it was difficult for everyone. And I think that there were many, many pressures on us that only came to light later, including infiltration There is now evidence that there were agents provocateurs who were infiltrated into SNCC from some northern groups to make us more quote-unquote revolutionary. There was also evidence of the FBI's involvement. So it's a complex, not easy to read picture. But I worked very, very hard on it, and I had many, many nights of sleeplessness and many tears over it. But when I finished, I felt good.
So you feel like you can understand in a way that you couldn't understand at the time the decision to keep the organization,
yes, and I think
a black
my readers, I think my readers will understand, too.
In the connections that you've made between feminism and the civil rights movement, did being an early feminist help you understand that as well?
Oh, yes, I think so. One's awareness of oneself as different or separate or estranged, that awareness feeds all questions involving identity.
Still, when you left SNCC, you also left being at the center of the civil rights movement. Was it hard for you to find a way to keep those ideals in your life, even though you are no longer an important part of an organization?
Well, SNCC was unique, a unique phenomenon in American political life. We were the most fiercely democratic organization that I've ever known, and had a kind of freedom insofar as our own ability to raise questions with astounding implications was concerned. We were going to the heart of some very fundamental questions involving the American democracy. We were doing so within our own framework, a very diverse, small group, and yet very powerful at the same time. And I realized as time went on after leaving that there would never be anything like this again in my life, that it was a moment in time that would never again come, and that I would have to continue to work based on those values, but I would have to structure them without the support of a group like SNCC. And it took me a while to do so, but I believe that I've done that.
Are you still in touch with all the people who you knew during the civil rights movement?
Many of them. A great many of them. Mike Thelwell, who's now a professor at the University of Massachusetts, Bernice Johnson Reagan at the Smithsonian, sociologist Joyce Ladner, Charles Sherrod, now in city councilman in Albany, Georgia. John Lewis was elected to the Congress last fall.
I think it's fair to say that many of the groups who started after the foremost groups of the civil rights movement really owe a debt to the civil rights movement in the organizing style of the groups and in their tactics.
Yes, and in their insight into how to bring about change in a liberal democracy such as ours, because we do have a very flexible system in our Western democracy. And much of what happened subsequently with the anti-war movement, the women's movement, later the environmental movement, is attributable not only in tactics and strategy, but also the basic philosophy of a responsive democracy and basic techniques for organizing, all trace back in some way through the 1970s and the 1980s. They trace back to SNCC in the early 1960s.
Mary King, I want to thank you for sharing some of your experiences and insights with us today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Mary King has been my guest, and she's written a memoir about her years in the civil rights movement. It's called Freedom Song, a personal story of the 1960s civil rights movement, and it's about the years that she worked with SNCC. And Freedom Song has just been published, and it's published by William Morrow. My name is Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Wes Craven, one of the top directors of horror films, and his credits include Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, and Nightmare on Elm Street. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, singer Frankie Lane explains how a boy from the big city became known for his songs of the Old West. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz looks at the music and arts programs of America, the record company responsible for preserving historic concert recordings. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg explains why many people read the headlines last. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Today, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz departs slightly from his usual record review to talk about a small record company called Music and Arts Programs of America. Lloyd says their unusual catalog offers some of the best historic live performances ever recorded.
A little later, I'll play you an excerpt from a remarkable new old recording. But it's not so much a particular performance I'd like to call your attention to. It's a recording company, Music and Arts Programs of America, the latest incarnation of what used to be officially known as and is still sometimes called the Bruno Walter Society, or Disco Corp. This is an organization I'm devoted to because they perform an invaluable service to music lovers and record collectors. Along with some excellent new recordings, they release in the best available sound historic recordings, most of them from actual live concerts. They have superb taste in the musicians they concentrate on, including some of the century's greatest conductors, Arturo Toscanini, Wilhelm Furtwängler, Otto Klemperer, and naturally Bruno Walter. As Music and Arts, they're now producing only CDs, although some of their earlier LPs are still available. Of course, even at its best, the sound of a live recording dating back 30 or 40 years doesn't have the glamorous sheen of today's digital engineering. And some of the performances lack the technical finish that can only be created in a recording studio. But it's the rarity and vitality of the performances themselves that make these discs so precious. For example, there's Music and Art's new issue of the Bruckner Sixth Symphony that Otto Klemperer performed with the Concertgebouw Orchestra of Amsterdam in 1961. Klemperer shows us just how Bruckner, in this marvelous but relatively ignored work, takes his two idols, Beethoven and Wagner, and makes them sing with his own eccentric but heroic combination of solemnity and naivete. Here's the fanciful trio section from the third movement.
Thank you.
3.5 years later, Klemperer made a studio recording of this with the New Philharmonia, and it's one of his most beautiful Bruckner performances. Angel Records has just reissued it on cassette. With all its precision and beauty, and the authority of a conductor admired for his deep penetration of this music, you wouldn't imagine much was missing, until you hear the more personal inflections of the live performance, the more exciting sweep from phrase to phrase and movement to movement. In spite of some raggedness of ensemble, and the feeling of listening to an old radio broadcast, no other performance can take its place. The CD also includes a fascinating live performance of the Brahms Variations on a Theme by Haydn. The Music and Arts catalog currently lists such choice items as Toscanini's live Verdi Requiem, his Beethoven Missa Solemnis, and even a 2-disc set of rehearsals for his famous broadcast recording of Verdi's Falstaff. There's the Furtwängler Don Giovanni, a Klemperer Beethoven Ninth, a Mahler Kindertotenlieder sung by Marian Anderson and conducted by Jascha Harnstein, and many more. These discs can be a little hard to locate outside of the large record stores, but you can write or call directly to Music and Arts in Berkeley, California. It's worth taking the trouble to find them. Even aside from the historical and musical value of these recordings, it's important to be reminded that making music is primarily a living experience, not only an electronic one.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He's a poet and teaches English and creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. The record company Music and Arts Programs of America is located in Berkeley, California. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is singer Frankie Lane, who's just re-recorded some of the Western themes he made famous, the themes from High Noon, Gunfight at the OK Corral, and Rawhide. During the 50s and 60s, Lane had 21 gold records, but a lot of listeners still associate him with his anthems of the West. Eric Kunzel, director of the Cincinnati Pops, immediately thought of Frankie Lane for their recording called Roundup.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling, on this our wedding day. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. Wait, wait long. I do not know what fate. Okay, correct. Okay, correct. There the outlaw band make their final stand. Okay, correct. Oh, my dearest, keep rolling, 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 though the streams are swollen. Keep them doggies rolling raw high through rain and wind and weather, a hell band for leather, wishing my gal was by my side. All the things I'm missing, good victuals, love, and kissing are waiting at the end of my ride. Move them out, hit them up, hit them up. Move them out, hit them up, raw high. Cut them out, ride them in, cut them out, ride them in, raw high.
When I spoke with Frankie Lane, I asked him how an Italian boy from Chicago wound up singing about gunfights and herding cattle.
In the beginning, I guess you might say that I was wondering what a city boy was doing singing country and western songs and Wild West themes. But apparently, I guess I was like any other kid who watched the cowboys and Indians movies. I was crazy about westerns. And maybe it all harks back to that. I really don't know. But it all seemed to come naturally, and I didn't seem to have any trouble adjusting to that genre of music. And I was crazy about some of the songs that came along, some of them were pretty hokey, but things like Cool Water and Tumbling Tumbleweed were just fantastic for me vocally as far as interpreting them. And yet I never sounded exactly like a country singer in the sense of a Jim Reeves or any of those guys.
You know, I remember whenever I used to see you on the Ed Sullivan Show, I used to always hope that you'd sing Rawhide. And the times I saw you, you never did. So I guess I wonder if you've ever included that as part of your repertoire and performances.
Well, part of the deal on Rawhide entailed the proviso that I had to record the song first and that it had to be out at least 8 weeks prior to the TV show going on the air, which it was. And I was glad because by the time the TV show did debut, the record was a smash and it was fighting for the number one spot. In fact, the producers themselves told me later that the theme song, the popularity of the Rawhide record, kept the TV show on the air for about 4 months, and everybody laughs when I tell them that in the show that I do now. And then I say the TV show caught on and kept me on the air for 7.5 years, so it turned out to be good for both of us.
No, I wouldn't laugh, because even when the reruns came on just a couple of years ago, I would tune it in just to hear the theme song.
Well, there you go.
Did you enjoy the opportunity of doing a send-up of all of your Western themes when Mel Brooks asked you to do Blazing Saddles, the theme from his Western spoof, Blazing Saddles?
I have to confess, Terry, that I was a complete dummy about that whole situation. I was working Vegas at the time, and I happened to do a Merv Griffin guest shot, and I didn't know that anybody was watching who would be involved in filming a movie at that time or had just filmed a movie. Now, I get a call only about 20 minutes after the show went off the air from Mel Brooks, and I thought it was a gag. And I didn't know too much about Mel Brooks at that time. And he said, "I'm Mel Brooks, and I'm producing a picture called Blazing Saddles, and we have a theme song that we would like for you to do." And nobody told me that this picture was a comedy or a takeoff. I did it absolutely dead sure, certain, serious. And then I was stunned when I saw the preview. I happened to be in, I don't know, we were touring somewhere, and they had a preview of the movie, and I almost died when I realized that I was part of a big comedy setup, and I got ribbed about it an awful lot. But he said later, he says, "That's why we didn't tell you." He says, "We wanted you to do it dead serious."
He rode a blazing saddle, he wore a shining star. His job to offer battle to bad men near and far. He conquered fear and he conquered hate. He turned dark night into day. He made his blazing saddle a torch to light the way.
It's kind of ironic that you, one of the men with the biggest voices in pop music, was discovered by a man with one of the kind of smallest voices in singing. And I'm thinking of Hoagy Carmichael, who was a wonderful songwriter and a wonderful singer, and whose style of singing I think of as being very different from yours. What's the story of how he first heard you?
Well, I was hanging around a little joint called Billy Berg's in the middle 40s, like 45 and 46. And Billy, who ran the place, was a good friend of mine and used to let me get up and sing every once in a while with whoever was headlining there. And one night I happened to pick Rockin' Chair, and it was a jazz joint in those days, so I always sang something in that vein. And I didn't know that the composer, Hoagy Carmichael, was going to be sitting out there that night. And after I finished, to a nice, you know, polite round of applause, I started to walk off the stage. I put my glasses back on, and there was this guy at the bottom of the steps waiting to talk to me. He says, "What's your name?" I told him. He says, "Where are you working?" I says, "I'm not." He says, "Well, come with me." So he took me over to Billy. He says, "Billy, why don't you put this kid to work? He sings great." And Billy laughed, and he says, "What for? He comes in and sings every night for nothing." But he did put me to work, and that was the beginning of the whole thing.
I think most of your listeners are most familiar with your pop music hits. One of your albums that I like best is of you singing jazz standards with an orchestra led by trumpeter Buck Clayton. And it's a side of you that I think probably a lot of people are not familiar with. I wonder how come you headed in the pop direction instead of staying in jazz-style singing?
Well, a lot of it was pure accident. While I was working at Billy Berg's, a guy by the name of Edgar Hayes came to work there headlining as a small quartet that really I used to use them to sing with me, to back me up while I was doing the intermission singing. And I happened to ask him if he remembered an old tune called That's My Desire. He says, no, but that's a great tune. He says, I think it'd be good for you. To my complete surprise, after I finished the song, there was absolute pandemonium. And Billy Berg's wife came running up and said, Frank, do it again. So that night I did it 5 times, and that night changed my life. So that is a pop song. So all of a sudden, I get a hit with a pop version of an old tune, and it just carried me in that direction. And that's how I got laid in that slot. And no matter how many jazz things I did after that, nobody would really ever accept me as a jazz singer. So you figure it out.
You know, I know you had a triple bypass just a few years ago.
Quadruple.
Excuse me. Gosh, and you're still singing. And I don't know. Were you worried that you wouldn't be able to perform again when you were about to undergo the operation?
Well, that was a big concern because, you know, when they split you open like that to do open heart surgery, you have to have a respirator tube down in your throat to breathe for you. So they said, we don't know what you're going to sound like when this is over. And I was speaking pretty high after the operation. And it took me about, I would say, 3 months before my voice came back down to what I feel is my proper register. And then it was about another 3 months before I actually tried to do a concert. And after that night, everything was absolutely just like it ought to be, not a drop of perspiration, no panic, no nothing, no trouble breathing, and I knew that I was home free.
Well, I'm thrilled that you're still performing, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us, Frankie Lane.
Okay, thank you, doll. Bye.
Frankie Lane spoke to us from KPBS in San Diego. He sings with the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra on the new record, Roundup. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you covering today?
Oh, we're covering minesweeping activities being stepped up in the Persian Gulf and Attorney General Meese's second day at the Iran-Contra Committees. Also, I have a little sound experiment for you.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Can you tell the difference between this recording of 5 piano notes and this recording of the same 5 piano notes?
They sound pretty much the same to me. Does that make me deaf?
Well, it makes you different from most of the people in our report tonight on digital audio tape. Stay tuned.
Okay, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Catchy colloquialisms in newspaper headlines don't often translate well. Our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has these thoughts on what it takes to understand them.
I don't know how many times I've heard someone who is about to embark on the study of a foreign language say, oh, I don't really want to master the language or anything. I just want to know enough French or German or Spanish, as the case may be, to read a newspaper. Whenever I hear someone saying this, I recall a story I heard from a British linguist I know. He found himself in Cleveland a couple of years ago and happened on the following headline in the sports pages of the local paper. Tribe, Homer, Barrage, Salvages, Split. Now, an American reader would have little trouble making sense of this. The Cleveland Indians, the Tribe, had hit a bunch of home runs in the late innings of the second game of a doubleheader, having already lost the first game, and so managed to preserve a split, one loss, one victory. But my friend was baffled, even after he read the accompanying story, until his American wife took pity on him and explained matters. He was so fascinated by the headline, in fact, that he took it back with him to England, where he posted it prominently on the door of his office and offered a free dinner to any student in the linguistics program who could decipher it. Needless to say, he hasn't had to pay off on his bet. As far as those Englishmen are concerned, Those five words, tribe, Homer, barrage, salvages, split, might as well have been a text in the lost language of the Etruscans. The fact is that in just about every language I know of, you can achieve a mastery of the most difficult literary text years before you can make sense of a simple newspaper headline. And contrary to what you might think, the newspapers that are hardest to read are just the ones that cater to popular tastes. I was in New York the day after Fawn Hall had given her testimony to the House Senate Committee on the Iran-Contra business. The headline in the New York Times would have been comprehensible to a German or Frenchman who had been following the affair in the foreign papers. It said, North Secretary describes destruction of evidence. But the Lord knows what such a foreigner would have made of the headline in the tabloid New York Post, Fawn Shreds Ollie. Of course, foreign newspapers are no less opaque. In Italy, for example, the press has devised a rich vocabulary to describe the almost unimaginable variety of government crises that have been a staple of Italian political life since the war. Add to this the universal European tendency to refer to political developments by dates, and you get stories which translate into something like, the crisis may be slithering or super-piloted, but if there are no destabilizing hypotheses, it will result in a 23rd of May rather than a 17th of August. Compared to prose like that, Dante is child's play. Now, the point of all this is not so much that newspapers use a funny sort of language. They have their peculiarities, sure, but really they're much more typical of ordinary language than high literature is. Most of our everyday language is designed for efficient communication with people who already know a lot about the subject under discussion. That's what makes the tabloids so easy for us to read. The language can be simple because the background is rich. But until we sit down to read somebody else's tabloids, we're apt to overlook the wonderful efficiency behind that simplicity. If you really have your heart set on learning enough French to read a newspaper, by all means go for it. But if I were you, I'd take a 4 or 5 year subscription.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's what's coming up on our next program. On tomorrow's show, I'll speak with novelist Alice McDermott. Her second novel, That Night, sets the intensity of young love against the protective security of suburbia. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review Roseanne Cash's new album, and film critic Stephen Schiff will review the new James Bond film, The Living Daylights. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.